Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We brought the global economy back from the brink. We laid the groundwork today for long-term prosperity as well.
President Obama speaking the other day about the success of his economic recovery plan. Does the economy feel like a success to you? It apparently does to the president.
It's worth recalling the situation we faced 6 months ago. A contracting economy, skyrocketing unemployment, stagnant trade, and a financial system that was nearly frozen. Some were warning of a second Great Depression. But because of the bold and coordinated action that we took, millions of jobs have been saved or created. The decline in output has been stopped. Financial markets have come back to life. And we stopped the crisis from spreading further to the developing world.
Sounds like everything's great, including jobs being created. But here is a contrast. There's the president's words on the one side, the Dow climbing back to 10,000 on the other side, on that side, but the unemployment rate is climbing to 10%. Here's another contrast. At the height of the crisis a year ago, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was calling it a housing correction. My next guest calls it the second great bank depression. And one more. President Obama calls Tim Geithner Treasury Secretary of the United States. My next guest calls him Pollyanna. And once the bank's broken up. Noemi Prinz is that guest, a former managing director of Goldman Sachs, who now writes on corruption on Wall Street and Washington for and in Washington for Mother Jones, Fortune, Daily Beast, The Nation, and elsewhere. And now she is author of It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street, published by Wiley. Noemi, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian.
For our listeners who don't know you, give us some background on yourself. When were you a managing director for Goldman Sachs?
Well, I was a managing director until 2002, which was when Enron and WorldCom basically collapsed and we had the market collapse and we saw this immense systemic fraud. That was around the time where I thought I had enough inside of Goldman. I had also been at Bear Stearns running a London analytics group for years, and I just thought it was time to get out, talk about what was really going on, and that's really what I have been doing since then.
It's all so mysterious to us regular people who've never worked inside that fortress. What does a managing director do?
Well, there's a lot of meetings that involved in being a managing director at Goldman. There's a lot of fighting for your bonus, which might be obvious to everybody who sees how high they are, but literally it will take 3 to 6 months of many discussions, taking credit for a lot of transactions and trades and trying to figure out who got what amount of money to the firm so they can argue with senior management about how much they can make at the end of the year. And this is the kind of thing that really drives almost everything internally.
Are you willing to say the biggest bonus that you ever got?
I actually left before I established the biggest bonus I ever got. I was on track to almost making a seven-figure bonus, and I left before that. I did not get that bonus because I was not at the firm for long enough. I forfeited the options and the bonus, and I became a journalist for far, 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 far less, and I'm a much happier person for it.
Who was in charge when you were at Goldman Sachs?
At the time, Henry Paulson was in charge of the firm. He later went on to become the Treasury Secretary of the United States, as I was becoming a journalist. And Lloyd Blankfein, who is now the CEO of Goldman Sachs, was my boss's boss and head of the division, which was the trading division in Goldman, that is still the most profitable division within the firm.
What did people think of Paulson at the time?
I think people thought of Paulson as a deal maker, as the sort of very strong person. He commanded a room. I have a segment in my last book, my first book, Other People's Money, where it's a Christmas party, and he's standing there in front of all the managing directors at the party, and he's sort of parting his arms and being high and saying, you know, we're not going to have as high bonuses next year. You know, forget those extensions on those Hampton houses. You know, this was after the 2001 beginning of the recession and collapse of the market in Enron. And he just had this way of making people listen, of this really strong sort of fellow who had maybe not a power in intellect, but a power in just the gruffness of his voice and the size. He's a very tall man of his demeanor.
Did you and your colleagues see him as the kind of guy who would be a public policy czar to devote his life to working in the public interest as Treasury Secretary of the United States?
We certainly didn't. No one would have thought he would be devoting his life in public interest. He had some environmental interests that he did. But I don't think he actually did that as the Treasury Secretary. It was certainly a public position. But I would not argue that he did very much in the public interest, as opposed he was very clear as the housing crisis was beginning to be seen publicly that there would be no help for individuals, that people who made their own problems sort of had to sit in the weeds of those problems, and then went on, of course, to give the banking industry billions of dollars.
And, of course, we'll get to some of that, and our listeners know a lot of that. But how do you go from being, you know, a high priestess of investment banking to, maybe that's a little strong, to a muckraker about the industry that you were working in, and as cynical as you seem to be about it, do you have to have some kind of epiphany, or does it come on gradually?
I think it really comes on gradually. You're always there realizing that the amount of time that you spend arguing about money, which is really the point of investment banking, is very, very deteriorating kind of on your soul. There's an element of banking that has an intellectual kind of basis towards it. Structuring the deals that ultimately were at the center of this crisis had a sense of, do those numbers work? Is the system right? Are these models right? And explaining. The part of my job that I liked the best was actually explaining some of these things to clients. When I got to Goldman, the idea of being with clients was actually supposed to take a political backseat, political within the firm, to being political within the firm. And there's a real push at Goldman, if you want to succeed there, to be good at politics, good at internal politics. It's far less about the client and far more about the internal meetings and being in the right places and having the right conversations and sort of stroking the right egos.
And you said you also worked at Bear Stearns. How different was the culture from Goldman Sachs? Because, you know, again, from the reputation that us lay people out here get by reading stuff, Bear Stearns was a kind of bad boy investment firm. More brash, more aggressive, lots of risk. They didn't care at whose expense, resistant to oversight. While Goldman was more of a staid establishment kind of place. How much is there to that?
Goldman was much more of a bureaucratic structure in that respect. That's why it gets a sort of state establishment type of aura from the outside. It also has far, far greater ties with Washington. So because it's allowed or has far more influence on the regulations and the rules that bind it, it can act as if it is more secure in that respect. It sort of has, it is the government. It has the government's back. Bear Stearns was far more outside of that. I was at Bear Stearns in London when really at the very beginning. I left Bear Stearns at the very beginning of the types of securities and securitization and these things called CDOs and buckets of credit risk that we were creating at the time throughout Europe. And the office was quite small compared to Bear Stearns in New York, of course, and Goldman. And it did have a mentality of, you know, get the deal done, find the client, you know, hang out with them, and be fairly aggressive. But actually, it was a more direct aggressiveness. There was less politics within the firm than at Goldman. And so Goldman's politics basically extended from the firm to Washington. And when I got to Goldman, actually, when I interviewed at Goldman, Lloyd Blankfein took me aside, showed me the trading floor and said, Do you see this? I'm like, yeah. He's like, this is not Bear Stearns. I'm like, I know. This is not London. I'm like, I know. Yeah, this is Goldman. This is New York. We are different.
Nomi Prince, my guest on WNYC, former managing director for Goldman Sachs, worked at Bear Stearns, now the author of It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street, published by Wiley. Kind of on that point, what we hear from the right at the moment is that Washington has taken too much power over the private sector. And the stats show that the government owns a larger stake of private sector America than maybe ever before. But you see it as Wall Street taking over Washington, don't you?
Yeah, well, Washington has basically subsidized Wall Street's failures from last year. When Wall Street was collapsing, when Lehman Brothers went under, when AIG couldn't pay its credit derivatives bets and its backing that it had made for Goldman and for the rest of the street, Washington came in and started, you know, the TARP program, the $700 billion program, and trillions of dollars of other programs between the Fed giving out cheap loans in return for quasi-toxic collateral, the FDIC having to get additional backing in order to help the banks raised more debt because they couldn't raise it themselves because they didn't trust each other and nobody trusted them. And the government stepped in to do that. So the government did not step in to actively participate in managing these firms. They did not actively and still have not given rules to restrict their behaviors. There's more leverage and more trading going on right now than there was before the bailout. The difference is that it is going on with government money.
More leverage going on than before the bailout?
More leverage because it is going on with government money. Leverage right now is rising to the rates of 2007, which was basically right before a lot of the toxic assets started to hit the market and before nobody wanted them. The banks didn't want to buy them. No one else wanted them. And they drained borrowing. They drained debt. They drained leverage from these banks. And so that's why the banks had no choice but to come to Washington and ask for money, which they got. Now their trading is being subsidized by government money. Last quarter, many banks posted record profits, including Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo. J.P. Morgan almost posted record profits. They were close on trading profits. Trading is based on leverage and capital, which has now come from the government.
Here is your old boss, Henry Paulson, as Treasury Secretary a year ago, October 2008, saying how the money that we, the taxpayers, were pouring into the bank should be used.
The needs of our economy require that our financial institutions not take this new capital to hoard it, but to deploy it.
So according to you, are they hoarding, deploying, or some other?
They are hoarding it and deploying it for their own benefits. Last year, when the first bit of money was given out from Washington, for example, J.P. Morgan Chase, which had already been given and had backed Bear Stearns when it was taken over by J.P. Morgan in March, was also given Washington Mutual, again with government guarantees to become one of the, well, the second largest bank in the country. That's deploying money. That's not using it for credit to help people. It's not using it for credit to help negotiate the loans and the mortgages of people that continue to foreclose. Right now, we're up by 15% in foreclosures this year versus last year. The credit losses that are coming into banks are continuing to increase, which means people in general are finding it even harder this year to pay or to renegotiate their loans than last year, whereas the banks are posting profits. So they took the money, they deployed it to either merge and acquire and become bigger banks to inflate their trading businesses, but not to give credit to the general population, which is why we see those loans continue to decline.
So what's the main policy battle now, as you see it?
There's a couple policy battles going on right now. One is there's a battle for a Consumer Financial Protection Agency to try and shore up the kinds of practices at the loan level that went wrong and that ultimately created this big meltdown.
Why think that that would do anything? I mean, why wouldn't that be just another piece of bureaucracy that may or may not work, that the SEC didn't work, they didn't catch Madoff, and they didn't catch the securitization bubble? Why would this work?
Well, that's really good. It will only work if it is given power and if it actually has the passion to work. I think the SEC failed miserably. The SEC is still failing. They still have a leverage level at 30 to 1, which actually Hank Paulson and others pushed to get done in 2004 instead of 12 to 1. They still have the same rules in place that have created this catastrophe that are under their ability to change. Same thing with the Fed, which is a whole other topic. They continue to let banks merge, worry about too big to fail and everything else. So the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is merely at least to show, look, there is something else here that is on behalf of consumers. It might be equally as bureaucratic and not have as much power and not do as much. But it is saying, look, we have a chip on the table as well, to just be a checks and balance and sort of a counter balance to the fact that the banking industry basically has been able to control and maneuver so well its own set of regulations or lack thereof.
And the argument against too big for fail is pretty clear. If they're deemed too big to fail, that means these companies have a kind of permanent guarantee that the taxpayers will bail them out again, and therefore a permanent license to take stupid risks. Heads I win, tails the taxpayers lose.
Exactly, and that is why their trading profits are up, even though their credit losses from consumers are rising.
But how do you do it? How do you break up Goldman Sachs, let's say, in a way that solves the problem but still lets business take place?
Well, Goldman Sachs is unique because Goldman Sachs was allowed to become a bank holding company, or something that gets legal access to the federal bailout money, last September 21st when they had zero capital or were about to go bankrupt themselves and came to the Fed and said, help us. The Fed said, okay, you can become a bank holding company. So can you, Morgan Stanley. So one thing is to bring them back into. They're not a bank holding investment company. Wait,
that's one version. Goldman
Sachs,
isn't the Goldman Sachs version that they didn't need the bailout and the government asked them, please, please, please take the bailout because we don't want it to look like some firms are in bad shape and some firms are in good shape?
Yeah, and that's what J.P. Morgan said. And that's really delusional because even though they only took $10 billion from TARP money, they took another $54 billion in other government guarantees and subsidies. They took $13 billion for their losses to credit to AIG, which they said they didn't have. So there's a lot at Goldman where they say one thing and do something else. They don't want government oversight.
Why do you call Tim Geithner a Pollyanna in the book?
Well, Tim Geithner was in a position where he could be realistic with what's happening. He could actually come in and do something about too big to fail. He could talk about reinstating something like Glass-Steagall, dividing commercial banks from investment banks, taking the government out of the equation for backing the risk of banks and keep them in the equation for backing consumer deposits and things that deal with the public who basically sustains the government through taxes and other things. But instead, he talks about how, as did Obama in the clip earlier, things are better. You know, the market's better. Banks are better. We're healthier. And the thing is, banks are better. If anyone gave anyone so much money to do what they do, we would all be better off. But the rest of the economy isn't better off. And that's a very unrealistic position to take, to say, look, everything's better. Make that be the sort of be-all, end-all conclusion of this crisis, whereas the only thing that is better is some of the health of the largest, most powerful banks and not really individual consumers.
You have a stat in the book, something like, if the money that was given to the banks was instead used to help homeowners, they could have paid off every struggling homeowner's mortgage in America. Was that just to make an impression, or is that actually number crunching?
No, that's actually true. There were $1.4 trillion worth of subprime loans in America and a little bit more than $10 trillion of total mortgage loans. If they had all gone to zero, all of them. I mean, zero. I mean, the houses were annihilated, not even that they couldn't be paid upon. That would have been that $10 trillion. But you could have stopped the losses and the foreclosures coming in by a fraction. You could have taken that $10 trillion, put in just a couple hundred billion, and you could have stopped the losses coming in and kept people in their homes. And so that's why I say that number. There was $14 trillion worth of asset-backed and toxic assets created on the back of these loans. That's what we saved. Not the loans.
Would that have been a good alternative way to go, or would it just make us feel good to think so? Buying up all the bad mortgages, bailing out the homeowners instead of the banks.
Bailing out the homeowners would have bailed out the banks and the homeowners, and that's the real difference. It could have felt good, but mathematically, those loans go into toxic assets. The toxic assets had no value. They were borrowed against. They brought down the banking system. We paid trillions of dollars to prop it up. If instead those loans had been made whole, those toxic assets would have not had the same losses, and we would have had more time to work at a system of actually reforming and regulating while keeping people in their homes, and it would have been cheaper.
You were an investment banker before you were a journalist, a managing director of Goldman Sachs. Are you a capitalist?
I am a progressive capitalist, if there is such a thing. I believe that capitalism can only work if it works for everyone, and that what we have is this totally unequal, disconnected, influential by only a very tiny, small segment of the upper echelon of the banking powers and the CEOs in a small group in Washington that is revolving in and out of that world. And that's not actually capitalism. You know, a progressive sort of world would allow people to do what they do and compete and everything else, but it would also make a fairer playing field, which we do not have.
Michael Moore was here last week talking about his new film, Capitalism, A Love Story. And here's a little of what he said about capitalism.
It is not a system that's well-structured for the 21st century. And I'm really tired of the debate between capitalism versus socialism, a 16th century economic system versus a 19th century economic system idea. I mean, we are in a whole different time right now.
Your reaction to that?
We are in a different time, and both socialism and capitalism, the words are in a time in which there is so little government help on the socialistic side, on the idea of propping up the general economy. We talk about GDP and bank profits and the stock market, and that has nothing to do with anyone else. And so that definition of capitalism is just deteriorating to so many individuals. Maybe the words themselves are old, and they're that you know what he said was quite interesting. But the notions can make sense. If we look at economic stability rather than socialism or capitalism for like a greater swath of individuals, then what we do is we do use our taxes and the money that we put into the government to make the world and the economy better for everyone else. And we can help with healthcare, and we can help with mortgages, and we don't let this overpower of a very, very small cartel of people and banks control everything.
And we're over time. But people who will disagree with you will say, no, no, that's what they have in Europe. Much less risk, more security, more economic security, but much less opportunity on the upside, say, to get rich.
But there's an opportunity, and there's an opportunity to be substantially too rich and too in control of something that hurts the rest of the population. And I think what there is in Europe, and I lived in Europe for 7 years, I think what there is there is more stable and more comfortable to a greater group of the economy and more people, and there isn't as much worry. And not having worry about your economic situation, that it's going to be put on, you know, thrown on your head and taken away and given to a more powerful group of people, actually makes you better people. It makes you happier. It makes you more economically stable. And I don't care what you call that, it makes more people more better off.
Nomi Prince, author of It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street, published by Wiley. She will be at the Strand tonight at 7, talking and signing. And on October 1st, that's Friday,
Thursday,
she'll be at the Ethical Culture Society Thursday night for an event with Demos, where she's a fellow at that think tank, and The Nation, Thursday night at Ethical Culture, tonight at 7 at The Strand. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, it's our informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific, and only about 7 minute long primary day runoff exit poll. And we really want to know, because so few people are going to vote, that if you're one of those few, you're going to decide between Bill de Blasio or Mark Green for public advocate, John Liu or David Yasky for New York City controller. So call us up right now if you are voting and tell us who you're voting for, de Blasio or Green, Liu or Yasky. And if you voted for one of the others in round one, where did you land? I'd love to hear from some of you. 212-433-WNYC.